Hello, everyone, and welcome to Real Estate Right Now, where real estate matters that matter to you. That's what we talk about. We're live from the Lindencraft Team Studios here in Raleigh, North Carolina, part of the Research Triangle Park. I am telling you what, today's show, oh, man, it is going to blow you away. We get so many requests on Real Estate Right Now for talking about investing in real estate. Well, I want to tell you something. Today, we have the guru. Oh, yeah, he's here. His name is Jason Kojak. He's written this book, outstanding, comprehensive book on A Beginner's Guide to Investing. It is entitled A Beginner's Guide to Building Wealth with Real Estate. Available on Amazon, by the way. And it's available on Kindle, too. Is that correct?
Yep.
Right? And Kindle and paperback.
Yep.
And hopefully we can get Jason in the studio somewhere so he can read this book to you so we can get it on Audible. That's what I'm kind of hoping next.
That'd be great.
Yeah. And by the way, if you need some help with that, let me know. I did that with one of my books.
That's great.
By the way, I was just to say this book, as I said, is very comprehensive. Listen, here's the thing about investing with real estate. You know, everybody wants to do it. There doesn't seem to be a bad market for it ever to invest in real estate. There always seems to be a great market for it. But it is not always the easiest thing to understand, which is why we wanted Jason to come on here and talk about it. So, Jason, welcome to Real Estate Right Now.
Thanks for having me. Okay. I'm excited.
So, Jason, how long have you been doing real estate investing or related activities? Because I know you're in real estate yourself.
Yeah. So, this is my 20th year. So, I started in...
what were you, three?
Yeah. I was I was actually 22 when I started, right out of college.
Whoa, wait. Hold on. I'm trying to do the math here. Hold it here. Yeah. So you said this is your 20th year.
Yep. So I'm 42.
No, there's no way.
Yeah.
There is no way you're 42.
Is that a compliment?
Yes.
Well, okay.
Yeah, no.
I mean, you look I got two kids at home, so maybe I feel a little older.
No, you don't. You're 18,
yeah,
man.
No. That's just some face lotion and a quick shave. That's all that is.
Okay. So you've been doing this for 20 years, mm-hmm. and you have investments, right?
I do, certainly.
Right. How many investments do you have?
Right now, I've got six core that I kind of use. I interchange in and out of some of my properties. Currently I have six.
So you interchange.
Yeah.
Oh, see, that's a teaser, right? That's a teaser because now you've got people going out, well, what do you mean he interchanges? Do you want to explain what interchanges
are? Yeah, so for me,
is that too early?
No, that's fine. Yeah. So for me, I'm a big value add person. When I look at properties. And so, as you were saying, you can invest in any market.
Right.
And I think part of investing in any market means that you always have an exit strategy.
Right.
And you need to have multiple exit strategies because when you go to exit, you don't know what market you'll be in.
Right.
And so for me, when I look at properties, one of the things I always try to do is come up with a plan B and a plan C. So what is my value add?
Okay.
And so sometimes I'll have a property where maybe it'll shoot up like this in value. And I say, gosh, you know, if I sold that property, maybe the profits have kind of leveled off.
Okay.
I could take that money and go out and find another value add property that goes like that as well.
I gotcha.
So similar to that.
So it's basically like if you're smart about the stock market, in case any of you know about the stock market out there, but you sell high,
try
buy low. Maybe at least you try to, right?
Yeah.
Except that we also have some. Well, I mean, I guess it's kind of like getting a dividend.
Yeah.
When you have right when you're getting rent.
Yep.
From there, right? It's like getting paid dividends, right? And the whole thing.
Yeah.
All right. So this book, The Beginner's Guide to Building Wealth. Let's talk about this with real estate. By the way, great book. Let's talk about the beginner, the person, because where do I start, right?
Yeah.
And I know that for you, in your book, you talk about setting goals, for instance, right? Let's just start there. Is that a good place to start?
That's a great place.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's chapter three, by the way, is setting goals. So, what kind of goals are we trying to set here when it comes to when we're trying to think about building wealth through real estate?
Yeah, so the first thing I kind of tell people to do is to think about how you envision your end goal, right? Mm-hmm. What is your end goal? How do you envision that? Don't worry about number of houses you need or anything like that. First, just envision what your end goal is and put a price on that end goal. So, in my teachings, I always tell people my end goal is I would like to retire at a beach in North Carolina. That's it. Pay off a beach house, live there, yeah. maybe have a couple cocktails on the beach, watch yeah. the sunrises, that fun stuff. But that's going to cost me.
Kids or no kids?
With me, I have two kids. I'm hoping they're in college or somewhere else. I might need to increase okay. that goal price. But, you know, and so I need to put a price on that. Right. And then I need to say, okay, outside of the housing, what is my medical cost? What is my living cost? What is my traveling cost? So I need to really start at the end. And I take all those things and envision it, and I try to put a price with it. Mm. Now, if my goal is not happening for 15 or 20 years, today's number is not going to be super accurate. Right. And so what I always like to do is I just do it once a year. I go back and I reanalyze my goal, because now I'm 1 year closer to retirement, and I have one more year of business. And so the thought process is that the sooner I can start that end goal and start analyzing it, I can become more and more accurate as I get to that point. And so what'll end up happening for most people is you're going to realize I've got this goal, and if I stay on my current track, I'm going to be a certain amount of money short. Hopefully not, but most people, their end goal is bigger than what they're going to end up if they just stay on their current track. I call that kind of the gap number, right? What is my gap number? How much am I going to be short if I don't change anything that I'm doing now to what I end up wanting to do? The gap is what I fill with real estate. And so that helps people say, okay, if my goal is $3 million and if I stay on my current track, I'll be at $1 million, then your gap is $2 million. Now, the average person is not going to save $2 million over the course of 10, 20, 30 years. But you can use real estate to do that. And what I try to teach people is that you don't need to own 100 homes to do that. You can own 10 really good homes to do that. And I think that is where there's some of the disconnect between kind of what we see on the internet and, right. and all these other things is it's, oh, buy an apartment complex or do all these crazy things. And the reality is the average person isn't going to do that.
Okay.
And so that's kind of where we start with setting your goals.
I want to ask you about that because as a psychological professional and digging into goal setting, which I did in grad school, by the way, was study that. One of the things I'm always curious about is, you know, we talk about you have to have regular feedback on your goals. How do you give yourself regular feedback? Because you certainly have to look at them more than once a year, don't you?
Yeah. Well, I'm a really OCD anal numbers person. So I tell people to do it at least once a year. And that's just as a hopeful, you know, minimum. I'm usually looking at mine every quarter to six months. But what I don't want to do is it's kind of like when you have a 401k. If you were to log into your 401k every day, especially over the past couple months, some days you're like, oh, I'm going to retire in 10 years. And some days you're like, oh my gosh, we're never retiring. And so there is this, you can have this emotional up and down that can discourage people from feeling like they're making actual traction. And so I tell people to set that goal and then don't check it every single day. Check it every 6 months. Now, I will say, as you get closer to your goal, so when I have millennials that I kind of coach and talk to that are 30 years away, honestly, once a year is probably fine for the first couple of years. But when I have people that are 5 to 10 years away, we got to be checking those a little bit more closely.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So one of the things that you talked about in your book is that you actually have like them stuck to your computer.
There's several places.
Right.
You have, I got my gap number.
Right. Is that what it is?
It is. Well, I've got, so on my kitchen, we have a little board on our refrigerator. We've got our groceries and things like that. And, I've got two things that are for me on there. One is a saying that says, I get to do this. I don't got to do it. Mm. And what that means is I try to just keep things in perspective that every day I get to do this. And so it kind of gives me the purpose to, I don't feel like it's a job or a responsibility. It's like a privilege to be able to do what I do. And the other thing is my number, my $3.6 million down to the penny. And it comes right off my spreadsheet. And underneath of that is my gap number. Currently, my gap number is $856,000. And if I don't change anything, when I get to retirement, I'll be $856,000 short. So my gap for real estate over the next couple of years is to fill that amount. That's right. And I put it everywhere. It drives my wife kind of nuts. she's like, do we need to see it everywhere? And I'm like, well, it's a reminder of why we work. It's a reminder of if we're pinching pennies, there's a reason behind it. And it's nice to scratch out that gap number when you sell a property or the market does good and be like, oh, wow, we're getting there.
Right.
So it's encouraging.
So it's encouraging at that side. Now, do you do any other goal setting in addition to that? In terms of when we're trying to, I mean, do you set like a goal for how many properties you might want to purchase?
For sure. Yeah. So once you have that gap number, even if it's not the most accurate, we need to say, okay, how many properties do I need to buy this year to try to fill a portion of that? And part of it is, you know, I could say, okay, hey, gosh, I could buy 10 houses this year and fill that gap number. But the reality is I won't be able to buy 10 houses this year and do that. And so, yeah, I set a number of properties that I want to buy as a rental. I set a number of those properties that I want to turn into an Airbnb, a long-term rental. Am I going to do a teardown one day? Now, I've been in this a little bit longer, so this, you know, you build to that point, of course. But it's not just for me, I'm going to buy three properties this year. It's I'm going to buy three properties. One, I plan on putting a long-term tenant in it, and that's because of reason A, B, or C. One is going to be an Airbnb, maybe because the location, and one will eventually be, you know, a teardown down the road that will build something else. Okay. And so, yeah, I definitely break that down.
Okay. So setting the goals is absolutely critically important. Let's talk about, though, something that I think is probably something that we don't talk about a lot, and that is understanding the economy and the markets. What do we need to know when it comes to understanding the economy and the markets, especially if you're a beginner?
Yeah.
Because, you know, I mean, real estate's real attractive.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the first thing is everyone wants to do it because we know there's a limited amount of land.
Yep.
Right? They're not building anymore.
They're not
making any more land.
That's right.
So it becomes really attractive.
Some of it's going away.
Yeah, some of it's going right. And so we get this sense of going, well, it feels safe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, safer to me than the stock market. I think for a lot of people, they feel that way.
For sure.
Right? So what should we know when we're trying to build wealth, when it comes wealth, when it comes to the markets and the economics of the...
So I think the amount of information is going to vary based on your goal timeline. And the reason I say that is because if I'm somebody who's 20 years away from my goal or 15 years away, I'm not going to be as concerned about today's economy necessarily. Because the reality is once I purchase that home, everything that happens in the economy from now until I sell that property, it's going to ebb and flow a little bit for me, but it's not going to really affect my portfolio, right? I tell people, you know, everybody that is watching this that has purchased the house in the last couple of years, I can say pretty confidently that your house is worth more than it was when you purchased it a couple of years ago.
Right.
But are you any richer? Hmm. No, it's fake money.
Right.
It's fake money.
Yeah, you use that term.
I do. Because I think what ends up happening is people put so much stock in what something is worth. And worth is determined by what you have in your hands. And so until I sell that property and take that profit, all I've done is have fake money on paper. It's the same thing, though, on a downturn. When the economy downturned in 2008, and we had real estate that dipped and people were freaking out. And I would tell people, look, if you're not selling, it doesn't feel good, but it doesn't matter. You haven't lost anything. It's the same reason why when we have down markets in the stock market, we all don't rush and sell our 401ks.
Right, right.
Because we don't need it today. And so when you're learning about the economy, the first and most important is what is my timeline overall? And then what is my strategy that I'm going to do with a particular house? Because that impacts what I need to know. For instance, let's say I'm going to buy a house and I'm going to hold this property for as long as I can, and I'm going to maybe give this property to my kids through an estate. Well, then what kind of interest rate I have today is probably going to be important, right? I want that because that's going to be kind of locked. But if I'm doing a property where I'm maybe going to do, like I said, a tear down, I don't necessarily care about my interest rate, because I'm not going to have that interest rate for that long. Does that make sense?
Sure.
So for me, one of the most important things for people to understand is how mortgage rates change. And there's a huge misconception that when the Fed gets out here and they raise rates, that is mortgage rates that they're changing. And it's not. It's short-term rates. It's your credit cards. It's your car loans. It's those type of things. And I don't know how technical you want to get, but in essence, you know, what we need to pay attention to is when we get mortgages, they're sold on the secondary market. And, you know, Fannie and Freddie buy right. them and those type of things. Well, when there's not a lot of those buyers, mortgage rates have to go up to appeal to more of those buyers. Right. And that's the situation we're in right now is, you know, with other returns on treasuries and bonds going up, you see some of these other mortgage buyers that are kind of like, well, if I'm going to buy a bunch of mortgages, I need the rate to be higher. And so understanding how that works, I think, is really, really important.
You had a really neat explanation, I thought, in the book about how banks borrow money and that's the rate at which banks borrow money, which I don't think people really understand about how banks will that when the Fed raises the rate, mm-hmm. really it affects their it's their rate for how much
that's right. What they're borrowing from other when that Fed rate goes up, and it's going to go up again in November. You know, banks have to carry a certain amount of money every night, and if they're going to be short, they have to borrow from another bank. And so in order for one bank not to gouge another bank, the Fed sets what this kind of rate range. And up until recently, it's pretty much been free money. They can just change in between. And so when a bank can get money for free, they can loan money at a much lower rate. Now the Fed has said, hey, if you're going to be borrowing money, we're going to make it more expensive. And the banks certainly aren't going to eat it. And so it gets passed down right. to the consumer.
But it doesn't necessarily go up at the same rate or change it.
Correct.
I think that's what people need to understand.
Yeah, for sure.
Go ahead.
Yeah. So, you know, for instance, when the Fed just last month said they were going to raise it 75 basis points, I would guess most people don't even know what that means.
Yeah, I don't think they do. Why don't you explain that?
So, you know, that's 0.75 points, right? So 100 basis point is 1%.
Right.
And 50 is 0.5%, et cetera. And so when they do that, they're in essence just increasing what banks are borrowing from each other, like we spoke about. Typically, I mean, and a lot of people don't know this, is when those rates are being spoke about going up. So right now they're talking about rates going up again in November. When that changes in November on that day, rarely do you see a big increase in the mortgage rates on that day. And the reason is because the mortgage rates change as soon as the Fed says they may change. Mm. They're baked in.
Right. In advance. They're baked in. Right. Yeah.
Right. And so understanding what the Fed may do in the future can allow a real estate investor, even on a very novice level, to say, oh gosh, if we're going to see more changes and it's going to happen prior to the Fed making their announcements, then maybe I need to be ahead of that curve. And I think that's where a lot of people kind of don't fully understand the markets.
So maybe let's, okay, so that's the big picture of the market, mm-hmm. right, in the economy. But there's a local picture, right,
yeah.
that we kind of have to know here too. So
for sure.
From a local market standpoint, what should a beginning investor take a look at in terms of local economies and local markets?
Yeah, so the biggest thing that I would suggest is understanding the supply and the demand. Because irrelevant of interest rates, supply and demand is what dictates prices typically. You know, we saw it in the beginning of COVID where, you know, people running out to get toilet paper, right? And all of a sudden, all of these things, it's supply and demand. And so one of the great things and the negative things about our market is we have very little supply. So the very little supply says, gosh, people really want to live here. The houses are getting snatched up quick. We're a desirable place to live. The downfall of that is that it does increase prices simply because there's less to pick from. And what we're seeing right now is that we still have relatively low supply, right. but yet we've got the interest rates that have gone up. And one of the things that when I talk to people and they say, well, gosh, I feel like the market's going to crash. And so I kind of help them walk through it. Well, explain to me why you think a market would crash. Price adjustments. Okay. So typically price adjustments to make a big impact have to happen on a mass level. I'm not talking about the seller down the street who's getting a job transfer who has to sell. I'm talking about 15 houses for sale in one neighborhood. And one guy drops 5,000 and then the lady next door drops 7,000 and you know, that TikTok, that's how we have mass price drops. The whole key to that is inventory. If we don't have 10 houses for sale in the neighborhood, that type of mass price drop can't happen. So I tell buyers, if you're waiting for this big mass price drop, I don't think it's going to happen. And, you know, if you wait for the rates to cool off, which I do think they will cool off.
Right.
They're not going to, just like they didn't continually go down, they're not going to continually go up. When rates cool off, what do you think it's going to do to demand?
It's going to increase it.
But it's not increasing our supply. So right. Once again, we're going to enter back into this market, not as crazy, but we're going to enter back into another market here locally. It's not a national comment. It's a local comment. We're going to enter back into where those buyers that have been sitting there, they're going to see it when you watch, when sometimes somebody comes out and says rates have just gone into the fives, you're going to see a frenzy because people are like, oh my gosh, it may go back up to seven next month. Because what we're seeing this time that we've never seen before isn't so much the increase in rates. It's the velocity at which it happened.
Right.
And it spooked a lot of people. And so I think when rates come back down, people are going to be fearful that they're going to shoot back up without warning. And it's going to increase demand. And when it increases demand, you've missed the boat for some of those opportunities that are out there.
And that is exactly what I just heard from you, was that, okay, yeah, the rates may be a little bit higher, but this may actually be your best time to invest.
Yeah, like you said in the beginning, you can make money in any market.
Right.
You kind of have to tune out the TV and the other people, right? Which is difficult listen to it, but yeah. You kind of have to look at it like we just explained in a common sense type of way. If you can get in at a high interest rate when there's a lower demand, okay, so eat the higher interest rate for a little while. And when rates go back down to a mid fives, refinance. But you've got the house
right
at a better deal.
And if we go back to your earlier comment, right, and you do that, it's fake money anyway until you sell it.
Doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. And what most people will end up discovering is, and this is one of the things I talk about in the book, is when you're setting your goals, or when I set my goals, I don't care about how long you're going to own the house. I care about how long you're going to own the mortgage. Because as an investor, one of the things that I do, and most investors do, is we go out and we try to leverage our investments to take money out to go buy something else. And so if I were to go and take property A that I've owned for 5 or 7 years and pull money out of that to go buy property B, the mortgage I had on property A is replaced with a new mortgage. So I could have a 3% interest rate, but it doesn't matter if I'm getting a new mortgage. So it's about the time that you're going to hold that mortgage, not so much the time you're going to hold that house.
So I know this isn't necessarily what you talk about in this particular section, but it did prompt a question in my head. And that is, so, all right, I want to do this, right? And maybe this is part of leveraging, which is kind of the next chapter, I think. But I want to do this. I want to get into investing in real estate. I got to know the economy and the markets. I do that. What do I need to do to get started?
Yeah. So you ever heard the saying, you know, keep it simple, stupid?
Yeah, of course, right? The KISS method.
Yeah. And so it is in essence that. I think the first thing you need to do is just understand your personal finances, right? How much do you have saved? How much can you afford to put down on a property? You know, those type of things. And then simply get pre-approved for just a normal investment loan, right? I think that's the first thing. I don't think you need to worry about these crazy kind of financial stuff and a bunch of leverage and that type of stuff. I think the most elaborate leverage the average person would do would be a home equity line of credit on their personal house to help for the down payment on their first investment. That's probably as crazy as anybody's going to get, and it's really not that crazy. And I would first just tell somebody to go out and just buy your average run-of-the-mill house, get it rented, get your feet wet. Don't go out and buy an apartment complex. Don't go out and buy some massive renovation project, you know, those type of things. I think that's the biggest thing. I tell people when you're building your portfolio, to think about it as if you were building a retirement portfolio. And so I try to tell people each house should be thought of as a company. And just like a stock, just like your 401, you put a bunch of different companies in there. Some are risky, some aren't risky. And you do that to diversify. And so I tell people when you go out and you buy your first house, buy your Walmart, buy your Coca-Cola, Buyer Johnson & Johnson. I want you to, you may overpay for that house. You're paying for security. You're paying for the neighborhood that has a long track record of always being popular. Neighbors take care of their yard. Get that one under your belt. Don't worry about the price. After a year or two, if you want to go buy the Tesla or the, you know, medical company that's riskier and you want to diversify your portfolio like that, that's great. If you look at it from that standpoint, I have various houses. I've got a 3-bedroom, 2-bath ranch with a 1-car garage in Cary. The world could be falling down around us. I could find a tenant like that every year. That's my Walmart, but I paid a premium for that property. But that property offsets my risky property that I'm just buying right now that I'm going to tear down and hopefully turn into a duplex.
Right.
That's a riskier project. So when you build your portfolio like that and you start with the secure asset, you get a little confidence, you understand it a little bit better. Property 2 and 3, you can increase your risk. And so it's really just like you would buy your primary residence. It's really not that much different.
You know, that's really interesting. You know, we talk about, you know, when we go to our financial advisor, they want to get your risk profile, right?
Yeah.
They want to talk about what your risk profile is. But the you kind of have to kind of know yourself here too pretty well, don't you? What your risk tolerance is.
Oh, yeah. I deal with a good amount of people that go out and flip properties. And it's interesting to me because, you know, they may be a more conservative person by nature, right? They're when they go out and buy a car, they're very concerned about gas mileage and, you know, all of these things. How long is it going to last? What's my dollar? But they will go out and try to take on a massive renovation project when they've never swung a hammer in their entire lives and know nothing about construction. Sometimes the allure of these TV shows that show these big checks push people into an uncomfortable zone that they're not used to.
Right.
And so you're spot on. You need to kind of know who you are at your core. And if you build on that, you'll get to that point. I think some people jump too early and that's where they kind of get a bad taste and can put themselves in financial struggles.
Well, I think people have this belief because there is a lot of these programs.
Yeah.
Programs out there. I just did air quotes for those people who are going to be listening to this on the podcast. That are out there that say, well, Jason, they told me that I could buy a house with no money.
Yeah. Yeah.
And your response to that is?
Your primary house, you might be able to, and then turn it into a rental. That's about the best that I could tell you. Yeah. I mean, there are always these one-offs, right? There's always these stories where, oh, somebody found a tax collection on a house that had been paid off, on an estate that somebody passed away without a will and had no heirs. And the list of all of these things that made that story happen go down the line. But that's what gets the headline because, oh, wow, you bought a house with no money down. And so it's just like with anything else in the world, you kind of have to read the full story to understand it. So the vast majority of people that are going to buy their first few rental homes are going to do it the very traditional way, traditional mortgage, purchase it, put a tenant in there, and then they will end up learning some of those leverage strategies so they don't have to keep saving money for a down payment.
So let's talk about one of the other myths that you've already alluded to, and this is the sweat equity myth, right? And I don't know if it's really, it's kind of a myth because, and I say it this way because you said it yourself. You know, if you've never swung a hammer before, right? If you never put a nail in, if you don't know the difference between a screwdriver and a pair of pliers, okay? Sweat equity is a myth.
Yeah.
Because you're not sweating.
No.
Matter of fact, you're sweating because you don't know what to do.
Yeah.
Because you don't know what to do.
Yeah.
Right? So I have a neighbor who flips properties, right? But he has his skill saw. And when he brings in contractors, in order to speed that process up, he actually helps them do their work.
Right.
So he speeds up what the contractor is doing.
Yep.
Right. So like, I mean, he knows how to tack carpet.
Yeah.
Right. And put that down. So he's in there with
doing that.
He's it with them. Right. He brings the contractor in and he's doing it with them.
Sweat equity.
Right. That's sweat equity. Right.
Yep.
But that's, again, he's got that skill set.
Right. Yep. And that's, you know, we see a lot of people that, you know, or my favorite is, well, my uncle's pretty handy and he's going to help me do it. You know, so I've never done it, but, and you see these things and you know, they're not pulling permits, or, you know, they don't understand that, gosh, a house in 1973 has aluminum wiring. Right. Not a big deal if you know what to do.
Right.
But, you know, so there's all these things. So, yes, sweat equity, I think if the opportunity presents itself and you know what you're doing,
right,
that's fine. But you do have to know your limitation, or else you're just going to put all your money at risk and probably not be on the winning side.
Well, and a lot of times, you know, like any house before 1978, right?
Mm-hmm. Lead-based paint.
Lead-based paint, right? And a lot of people go, oh, it's a great deal. Mm-hmm. I got this great deal. You know, it's a 1977. I'm like going, oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Really, did they paint over the lead-based paint?
Mm-hmm. Asbestos, what, popcorn ceilings. Popcorn ceilings.
What do you mean?
Yeah.
Right? And they don't see
That's
it.
Right.
I think this is the other part of the book that I think that you help people understand, is that there's just so many other things that you got to think about. You can't just go in there and just buy.
Right. Right. And that's why I say, you know, your first house or two really should be that simple, basic, right, secure house where, you know, you can get a home inspection on it. You can feel comfortable that you know what you're buying, and you can get a tenant in there and learn how to kind of manage it. And that makes the process a lot easier, kind of build. One of the things I tell people, you know, if you, let's say you own 10 houses, you don't own 10 houses. You own 10 roofs. Right. You own 10 HVACs. Right. You own 300 windows. And so that's where I think people kind of get tripped up too, is when they're starting to grow. By the time some of these problems and these capital expenses hit,
right,
they've run so fast that now they don't have the reserves to pay for those things,
right.
that are going to break. You're basically buying a used car.
Right.
And you got to put brakes and tires and that type of thing.
A little bit faster than you would if you bought a new car.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. And so that's why I tell people, when you start with that, and I think it's easier for the average person to grasp that and to not necessarily go out and feel like they need to find a steal, or brag to their friends, oh, I bought this house for $350, it's worth $400. Look, it's not worth $400 unless you just sold it for $400. It's fake money.
Right.
What I try to really drill into people is, you're searching sometimes for this deal that may feel like a deal today, but unless you're capitalizing on it and making that, it's fake.
Right, right.
It's fake.
That's the key operative term, right?
Yeah.
Fake money. By the way, it's A Beginner's Guide to Building Wealth with Real Estate, Jason Kojak. By the way, it's spelled K-O-G-O-K, all right? I said Kojak. That is actually the way it's pronounced. A Beginner's Guide to Building Wealth with Real Estate, available on Amazon. Bookstores near you. If they don't have it, you can just ask it. They'll get it in for you because it's got an ISBN number and they can pull that in. I know that. I've got 4 books on the market myself, so I know how this works. So,
and I will say, you know, one thing, if you do go search for it, so that you might find it under Plug the Holes, Fill the Barrel. That's kind of the main title.
By the way, this was the original.
Yeah. And I'd love to just take a second to explain where that came from, because I think it resonates with a lot of people. So when I teach a lot, I'll have people kind of shut their eyes and I'll say, imagine that that rain barrel that sometimes sits at the bottom of people's gutters. You know, they use it for water in their garden and whatnot. And typically there's 1 4-inch downspout off the side of your house that fills that. If you think of that as your job, as your income, right? And you think of the barrel as your bank account, and that's where all the money goes. And then there's that little spigot at the bottom, and that's how you pay your bills out of it, right? It makes sense like that. And that's what the image on the book is. And really what I want you to think about is, what happens if you get a clog in the gutter? What happens if a storm comes by, you get laid off, that gutter gets knocked off? You now have no longer have any income coming in. And so what the fill the barrel part is, keep your job. Keep your job at IBM. Keep whatever your job is, but start to fill little hoses in there. I don't expect your real estate to be the same size as that, you know, downspout off the bat. But if I have a problem with that main downspout, but I already have a few hoses in there, it's a lot easier to expand that because they already exist. And that's what I want real estate to do. And then the plug the holes part is really to say, you know, our money doesn't work with one spigot at the bottom, right? I've got a mortgage payment that's a softball size. I've got a car payment that's a golf ball size. I got a pinhole. I went to Starbucks today. I spent $3.19 for a cup of coffee. I can't, you know, that's what it costs nowadays. But if you start to plug those holes and you think about them not as one large expense, but individuals, you can start to master that financing and save so you can purchase that first property. So the plug the holes, fill the barrel is a mantra that I always try to drill into people's head and have that image.
I love that. That's beautiful.
Thanks.
I didn't even have to close my eyes and I got
it.
It was pretty awesome.
The explanation helps.
It did. You're really good at it too, by the way. So the next chapter, chapter five, financing and leveraging.
Yeah.
And we've kind of alluded to it a little bit. Mm-hmm. But you talk about saving money, maybe using your home equity as maybe a down payment.
Yep.
Right.
For sure.
To do it. Is there any other leveraging or financing techniques that we should be aware of?
Yeah. I mean, so one of the main things that most investors do is they're going to do what's called a cash out refinance on their investment properties. And all that really means is that after a couple years, maybe less of owning it, I go out and I get a new mortgage on that property. And because the value has hopefully gone up, I can take some of my original cash out. Now I can take that cash and I have that cash to use on another property. So in essence, it's about using the same money twice. Mm-hmm. And that's probably one of the most popular ways. There's also things like a 1031 exchange, which is really just an IRS rule that allows you to delay, not skip, delay paying taxes when you sell a property, which gives you more money then to again roll over into another property. The home equity line of credit is a wonderful tool. It can only be used on a primary residence, not on investment properties. And so that's a great tool. I tell people, there's people that have a lot of equity in their house today, and they maybe aren't going to plan on buying a property for a couple years. And I tell them, go out and open your home equity line of credit today. Don't draw on it and just leave it there sitting. The reason is because if we do have any sort of downturn on pricing, wouldn't I rather draw money on the value of my house when it's at a higher number? And that's one of those where it isn't fake money. Because if my house is worth $500 today, and maybe it's worth $475 next year, I'd rather borrow money on a value of $500 because the bank's going to give me more, and I can use that 2, 3, 5 years down the road. And so when we talk about the economy and that type of stuff and goal setting, a lot of the best investors are just proactive. That's really what they are. This past year, I have done 4 cash out refinances on properties simply because I said to myself, the rates are going to go up. So if I'm going to take I haven't spent any of it. I've cashed out on all my properties and I'm sitting on money to now that when the rates are higher, I can go out and spread that cash and not be as impacted by the higher rates. Mm-hmm. It's just planning. It's not rocket science.
No, but as you and I talked about before the show, not everybody is a great planner. And
well, that's true. That's true.
But it should give us some impetus, even if you're not a great planner, to go, I need to become a better planner.
Right. And I think also, I think one of the biggest things I talk about in the book, and I'm a big proponent of this, is the average person is not going to buy 10 and 20, 30 homes, right? They're not. If you can somehow put a plan together to buy 3 or 5 homes over the next decade, it's going to dramatically change your financial future. 3 to 5 homes over 10 years. Mm-hmm. When you look at it from that perspective and you say, gosh, I could buy a house every 2 or 3 years if I plan, that's totally different than some of the other stuff where it's like, oh, go out and buy a 100-unit apartment complex and multifamily and that is very intimidating to most people.
Right, when it should be.
It is. It's a different game.
It should be. Because I was just thinking about something we didn't really spend very much time on, but even getting a loan on an investment property is different than getting a loan for your home.
It is. It is.
It's a different rate, typically.
Yep.
It's just a very different, which is why you said early on, why don't you go ahead and see what you qualify for up front? Because it is different, isn't it?
Oh, it is different. It's, it's usually a bigger down payment. There usually is a rate increase. It can be anywhere from 0.25% to 0.75% higher. Your credit is going to be a little bit more impactful in regards to how credit worthy are you, what's your credit score, things like that. But again, if you just start by calling a lender, if you got a mortgage on your primary residence, call whoever that lender is. Start there. Doesn't mean you need to go with them. I have so many people that say, well, I don't want to get my credit pulled until, I'm ready. And I'm thinking to myself, gosh, you're worried about the wrong thing. Getting that credit pulled is not going to impact you on a mortgage that way. Right. It's not, you know. Now if you go out and you get your credit pulled on 10 different boat loans, that looks
right.
bad.
Right, right.
But people understand that when you're buying a mortgage, the credit agencies understand that when they get a mortgage inquiry, that you're likely to shop. And so it doesn't count every time they pull it. Mm. And so, but people are, I think people are scared to find out what's there.
Mm.
And I think some of this is kind of a, you know, coming to Jesus type right, of moment right, right, where right, you're right, like, okay, right. wow, this is going to take longer.
Right, right.
And so they punt it and hope something changes. And the most successful people didn't get there by hoping.
Right. Yeah, right. They planned and they got yeah, there right there.
Exactly.
So chapter seven, actually let's go chapter six.
Yeah.
How to run a complete cash flow. Because this is, you actually go against many of the experts in this chapter.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, the people I've interviewed on other shows have said cash flow is king.
Mm-hmm.
You are not necessarily that guy.
I'm not.
Okay. You need to probably explain
yeah,
that.
Yeah. Yeah. Those. And I am not the cash flow king. Now I will put it this way. I will never turn it down. I will never turn sure. it down. But here's what happens is, so you go and you buy that Walmart property. And it's very difficult to cash flow unless you put down a tremendous amount of money, right? Because it costs more because you've reduced that risk. So what do? You go out and you buy a lower price home in a transitional area or a tough part of town or a high supply area. The price is lower. You put an average tenant in there. And you getting $400 or $500 a month and you think that's great. But tenant has high turnover. So I've got really high vacancy, right? Or they do damage to the property. Or guess what? If it's a high supply area today in today's market, what is it going to look like in a down market?
Mm.
And so what I see people do constantly is they look for this cash flow. And when they sell the property, they're upside down. Or the amount of money they spend in repairing the property in between, they're upside down. Or there's no value add strategy and they're upside down. Or when they go to sell the property, people just, they don't want it. And in a down market, you have to protect yourself. So yeah, I would tell you for your first few properties, I don't worry about cash flow as much as I worry about the long-term potential of that house. So if I can keep a tenant in there with very low vacancy, okay, on an average house, that may save me $1,500 to $2,000 a year. There's some cash flow. If I get a good tenant in there who takes care of the property, my repairs are going to be lower, right? So there's all of those things. If I buy in a good neighborhood, I'm more likely to be able to value add to that property, renovate the kitchen, get more money, renovate the bath, get more money. You can't do that in every neighborhood. I can't go and drop a $20,000 kitchen in every one of my houses and get $20,000. In my nice neighborhoods, I can get $30,000 if I put in $20,000. It's a different end buyer. And so again, people talk about the cash flow. And the interesting thing is if you look at the numbers, if you get a 30-year fixed mortgage, for instance, and you raise rents 5% every year, every other year, not a crazy amount, and taxes and insurance go up at about 3%, in about 5 years, any property will cash flow. So you're going to get your cash flow. You just might not get it today. And I see people aim for the cash flow today and screw themselves at the end.
Mm.
And because people never think about the exit strategy.
Mm.
And again, the only time fake money becomes real money is when you exit.
Right.
And so they do a terrible exit strategy because they've been taught, let me look for cash flow, cash flow, cash flow. That's not changing your life. The exit strategy is how you change your life. That's my opinion. And again, that's for the average person who's going to end up having 3 to 5, 10 houses.
Right.
There are strategies. If I'm buying a multifamily apartment complex, it's all cash flow.
Right.
Because when I resell that, the exit strategy on multifamily is looking at cash flow.
Right.
But for the average person, that $200 a month is not changing them.
That may bring us to this other part of when we purchase a property is sometimes people purchase property thinking that, you know what, I'm going to have this extra money in my pocket.
Yeah.
And that's not, that's no, a myth too, isn't it?
It is. It is. Yeah. I mean, if you pay cash for the property, then you have a better shot because you're going to be getting a lot more. But for the person that's financing it, yeah, the reality is there's things that happen on an annual base in a rental property that don't show up every month. Right. So, I get the HVAC serviced. I get the gutters cleaned. Those things that pop up once a year that are $200, right? That eat some of that cash flow up. I've got my capital expenditures, right? My HVACs, hot water heaters, all of those things, roofs, all those things that talk about. One of the things we're seeing right now is insurance cost, insurance premiums that have gone up. As the cost of materials have gone up and the cost of labor has gone up, and we've seen storms intensify. I mean, I'm not even talking about hurricanes. I'm just talking about locally. Insurance premiums have gone up dramatically. Mm. And so we see these things that happen annually that don't show up on a monthly basis or every couple years, and people don't save for it. Those things aren't going to go away. Right. And so you have to prepare for those. And so that's why I tell people I don't worry about cash flow, because even if I'm making $300 a month now, I'm not, because when I replace the HVAC, I better have that money saved somewhere. Right. So it's the long game.
Right. I think that's the thing that people have got to pay attention to, because if you're in this thinking that you're going to be making the money off the rent check.
Yeah.
That's not really what we're trying to do here.
Not typically, yeah.
Because it goes back to your very first comment, right? You're filling a gap.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Right? You're filling the gap of your retirement.
That's right.
Is what you're trying to do. It's not money now.
That's right.
It's money later.
Yeah. And very few people are disciplined enough to take that $200 a month, sit it to the side, and reinvest it. It's just not the average person.
Right.
You know? And so, for instance, myself, every rent check for a particular property goes into that property, and we rarely take money out of it. And we sit it there and we invest it in, we'll put it into some stocks, or we'll put it into, I just bought a 2-year treasury bond last week, 4.25%. You sit it there for the next 2 years, right? And so those are the things, but I could have gone out to dinner and done that, but that's not the long game.
Right.
And so you have to be dedicated to the path.
Right. Yeah. You could have taken the rent check and went to Perry's.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Because that'd eat it up right away.
Yeah. Just myself. Yeah. Just yourself. Yeah. Yeah. My wife can go next month.
She next check. Next, right. Next check. She gets to go.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right,
so you have to be super disciplined.
Right.
And you have to understand that the benefit happens at the end.
Okay.
For the most part.
So let's talk about building a portfolio for the future, which we're kind of talking about. What are some other aspects about building this portfolio for the future? I mean, I know it's an end game.
Yeah.
But what are some other aspects we should be thinking about?
Yeah, I think so. Just as each house should be viewed as a company, I think you should understand how long you're going to have each house and what is that house going to do. So, so when I talk about building a portfolio for the future, so each house that I own, I have a plan assigned to it. I know which house I'm going to eventually cash out, refinance, but keep the house. I know which house I'm probably going to end up selling because it's kind of already peaked. I know which house I'm going to keep as a rental and probably never refinance or anything because I got a 3% interest rate on it and I don't want to do it.
Right, right, right.
I know which house I'm going to tear down and build a duplex, right? So part of that building your portfolio for the future isn't just buying it and hoping it does something. It's making sure that you understand it's just like the stock market. Some stocks you hold for a couple of years, some stocks you hold forever. But that is the plan that you have to take into that. And of course, a byproduct of that is how did I finance it,
right?
And what is my long term with how many homes I need to own to hit my gap? And so I think that's all kind of goes together when we look at building the portfolio.
We haven't talked about it, and I don't really remember you talking about it very much in the book. I may have missed it because I tried to read this relatively quickly in a very short period of time. But you didn't talk much about commercial investments, at least, or did I miss that?
No, I don't talk a lot about commercial or multifamily. The whole purpose of this book was to kind of speak to the, I don't want to say average Joe, but that's in essence, you know, who is going to end up owning less than five, maybe less than 10 homes over the course of a decade or so. Commercial and multifamily are great investments if you understand them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of people transition from pure residential, single family, into a multifamily space or into commercial, thinking that it operates the same. And they don't.
They don't.
Yeah. It's land.
Yes.
And there's a building. Totally different. I mean, just the type of commercial alone is, am I an office building? Am I a doctor's building? What am I?
Right.
And talk about wanting to understand the economy. Everybody needs housing.
Right.
What we've learned over the past couple of years is not everybody needs office space.
That's right, 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 right. Just look at the vacancies.
That's right. Right. That's right. And when we talk about, you know, I know a lot of people that own a ton of multifamily. On paper, the cash flow is amazing. But one of the things you see in lower end multifamily, which is a lot of, you know, hedge funds buy the $80 million apartment complexes. Most of our local investors are going to go ahead and purchase a 10 unit, an eight unit type of place. They're going to rent it out for $1,000 a month, et cetera. Unfortunately, that's a lot of your blue collar tenant. And when the economy turns, typically the blue collar employee is the first to get hurt. And what happens to my multifamily now? You know that. So that's why I tell people there is a time and a place, and you may build to that. But the average person can really do well with just your regular old residential.
Yeah, I think that's what the important message here. And so I'm glad I didn't miss it somewhere. Yeah. But I mean, I think that's the important message is that don't worry about those other pieces, because there is just such a difference if you got retail space or you've got office space or, you know, if you got warehouse space. Mm-hmm. It's a way different cap.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
And you just, we can't, and that's a whole nother book.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And I, you know, we're turning one of our rental properties into an Airbnb, for the first one that we're gonna do an Airbnb. And you would think, okay, you furnish it and you set it up on Airbnb. And it's like, as we dove into this, I'm like, whoa, there is so much more to short-term rentals than I thought, right? The budget alone, the expense, I'm now paying for Wi-Fi. I'm paying for somebody to cut the grass. You know, I'm paying for these cleaning fees. You know, all these things. We're having a debate. Well, not a debate. My wife will probably win, but we're having a debate. Should we? She's letting me debate it. But one of the things I said was, gosh, you know, should we make ourselves different by adding a electric car charger at our Airbnb? And so we did some research, and for where our house is, if I select that in Airbnb, it dropped down from, I think it was 63 properties to 3. So there's my value add. Now, of course, not everybody has a Tesla, an electric car, but where are we going in the future? And what can I do to separate? So for $1,000, I can have this attached to the side of this Airbnb.
No brainer.
No brainer. I won't even charge the people to use it, because the reality is that they're going to rent. If somebody needs it, they'll rent that house because of it. Mm. And I'm going for that target.
Love.
So
that. Love that. See, there's the strategy piece, the value add. Mm-hmm. Cause you did bring that word up, and I was going to try to circle back to it, cause you talked about value add and we didn't define it, but there's the definition of it right there.
Yeah. It's not gutting the kitchen and putting $60,000 appliances.
Everybody's got a kitchen.
Yeah. Yeah. It's okay. So if there's a dozen homes around me, do they have a grill? I'm talking for like an Airbnb. Do they all have a grill? Do they have a fire pit? What is their outdoor furniture like? How big's their TV? Do they have Netflix? These are the small value adds that we take for granted until you go to an Airbnb and you stay there and you're like, they don't have cable. Or they don't have Netflix.
Sony's PlayStation.
That's right. All of these things that for $2,000, you drop your, you may not increase your rental price because not everybody will care. You reduce your vacancy. And that's just as powerful, if not more powerful.
Okay. So we've got 1 minute, believe it or not. We've been on an hour.
Oh, wow. Yeah, yeah.
It's gone really fast. By the way, it's gone really fast.
Yeah.
So. But we should talk about tenant management, day-to-day operation, if we can do that in a minute real quick.
Yeah. So I think the most important thing I will tell you about tenant management is get away from the stigma that there's a hierarchy, that you are the landlord and they are the tenant. No, you are running a business. They are your customer. If you don't have customers, you don't have a business. You need to treat them like they are the customer. Fix repairs very quickly. Communicate all the time. Every one of my tenants gets a birthday text. Every one of my tenants gets a handwritten note and a gift card to a local restaurant when they move in. Every one of my tenants, if they have dogs, gets pet treats when they move in. I put all of their pet names in my phone, so when I call them, I ask about their dogs. Those little free things create a relationship. And when you have that, they don't want to destroy your house. They want to fix stuff themselves. I have so many tenants that are like, Jason, I don't want to call you, but the toilet's been running. Do you have time? I was like, yeah, we'll get, no problem. Do those small things. It's basically just being a good person. Right. And you will be amazed at the quality of tenant, reduced vacancy, and increased overall profit you'll make. That's probably the most simplest in a minute.
That's awesome. The book, A Beginner's Guide to Building Wealth with Real Estate. Plug the holes, fill the barrel, or plug the holes, fill the barrel. Yeah. A Beginner's Guide to Building Wealth with Real Estate. I don't care which one you want to look at. You've been absolutely fabulous.
This has been great. I love it.
And tell people how they get the book and get it if they have questions for you.
Yeah. So you can go on Amazon and just type in plug the holes, fill the barrel. Nobody else has taken that title yet, so it should be good. And you can always reach me at investorswealtheducation.com. So that's investorswealtheducation.com.
Awesome. Jason, you've been great.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Stay with me. Hey, folks, that's the show. I told you it was going to be fantastic, right? It was an investment show. Jason has been outstanding. Listen, I know that you have a lot of choices. You chose us. Thank you so much. I see all the loves that you've given us. And by the way, for those of you who are listening by podcast at this show at some time, you know what? Give us a little love, right? Go to your favorite podcast player. You know, give us a positive review. We always appreciate it. Tell your friends as well. As I say to you every week, thank you, everybody. And as I say to you everywhere, all over the world, ciao, everybody. It ain't worth living if you're dreaming small. Ooh, I want it all. Yeah, I want everything. You know it ain't worth living if you're dreaming small. I want it all. Living if you're dreaming small.